This is an ABC podcast.
So it's called Forever Happy Princess.
And it's a cruise ship?
Yeah, it's a cruise ship.
This is our producer, Iris Zhao. In 2017, she was on Hainan Island, watching people getting off the Forever Happy Princess, very excited about the cruise trip they'd just been on. So where had they been, Iris?
The cruise have taken them to the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea.
What do the Paracel Islands look like?
The islands are known by tourists in China as China's Maldives, just much smaller in size. There were white sand beaches, crystal clear seawater. The islands are kind of in the middle of nowhere, and it takes a whole night of cruising to get there.
What are these people doing on that cruise?
Well, cruise type of things. Partying, swimming, snorkeling.
Drinking.
Drinking and etc. But the tourists were asked also to attend a ceremony on one of those islands, where they will raise a flag, sing the national anthem, and say a pledge to China, and get back on the ship and come home.
Were you allowed on the ship?
Technically, I could be allowed on the ship, but just not as a journalist. It's a government cruise, and it departs from a port inside a resort guarded strictly by military personnel. And only Chinese citizens are allowed on the ship.
So why are drunk tourists colonising the Paracel Islands between mahjong and karaoke sessions? Well, China wants to show that the islands belong to them. And not just these little islands. They claim that almost the entire South China Sea, including any islands, rocks or reefs that happen to be in the middle of it, is theirs. You see, this strange little escapade into the South China Sea is part of something much bigger. A plan by Xi Jinping to claim all the territory he thinks belongs to China without triggering a nuclear war. I'm Matt Bevan, and this is China If You're Listening, a podcast about how the relationship between Australia and China came to the verge of collapse. Today, in our final episode of the season, will the US and China go to war? The South China Sea is one thing, but the island of Taiwan, just off the coast of China, is shaping up as the most likely spark for the next global conflict. It's the final battleground in a century-old civil war which has been frozen in place for decades. It's an almost unimaginably dangerous situation.
You know, the reality is that a conflict over Taiwan could easily turn into a nuclear war.
And one mistake could lead to catastrophe.
The one system, two countries arrangement.
And nobody wants that.
One country, two systems, I should say, yeah.
So how can it be avoided? A lot of people seem concerned that China is planning to take over the world one day with its increasingly powerful military. But the actual evidence doesn't point to that at all. China has shown no interest in invading and taking other people's territory. They just want to regain the territory they see as belonging to them historically. Like the South China Sea, a body of water half the size of Australia off the south coast of China. China says it's theirs. The problem with that is that there are other countries who disagree.
So you have China and the Philippines and Vietnam and Malaysia and Brunei and to a much lesser extent Indonesia.
This is Dr. Beck Strating from La Trobe University. She is very interested in the South China Sea.
So the South China Sea is a very complex geography.
But here's a non-complex way of understanding it. Imagine the South China Sea is a big pizza on a big table with five countries sitting around it. And each of these countries are claiming that the parts of the pizza they can reach without getting out of their chair belong to them.
Exclusive economic zones and continental shelves.
But there are parts of the pizza which multiple countries can reach.
Overlapping claims to maritime boundaries.
And that's pretty normal. Lots of parts of the world have that issue. But the unusual thing that's happening here is China is saying the entire middle of the pizza belongs to them, and everyone else can just have the bit of crust that's in front of them. And their justification for that is a map.
The main historical document that China uses is what we call the Nine Dash Line.
It's a map of the South China Sea with nine lines drawn on it, making it look like pretty much all of it belongs to China. China is pretty serious about this map.
One of the things that China tries to do with the use of the Nine Dash Line is to normalise this idea that it is part of China's territory. Now, we see this in the use of the Nine Dash Line map in popular culture. So there's been controversies around maps of China that have included the Nine Dash Line in the Abominable movie, for example.
Look at him. He's a Yeti. Cool.
What? No, Yetis don't exist.
Abominable is a DreamWorks animated kids movie that came out in 2019 set in China. Then there's this scene in the movie where a map is shown on the screen for a few seconds.
Dad always wanted me to travel the world. Someday.
And on the map is the Nine Dash Line. Honestly, it's there for like a few seconds, but just for that, the film was banned in Malaysia and Vietnam, who dispute China's Nine Dash Line claim.
So that's one example. There are other examples of China putting the map on passports and then countries within Southeast Asia refusing to stamp the passports because it contains this map with this Nine Dash Line.
The thing about the Nine Dash Line, though, is nobody but China is buying it. It doesn't make sense. The whole pizza can't be theirs. And this is where islands come into it. China says they own all the islands, so they get all the pizza around those islands as well. They're even turning small rocks and reefs into new islands by dumping lots of sand on them to try and boost the strength of their claim. They've also been building military bases on top of that sand to make it clear they're serious. But why are they doing this?
One of the key issues is just basically about geography. The South China Sea in China's strategic imagination is a near sea. It's very important for its security.
Basically, they want to make sure they can't be invaded through that sea. Then there's what's in the sea.
Control of maritime area can also come with lucrative rights to fish or to hydrocarbons.
So, fish in the water, oil and gas under the seabed. But there's one other reason, and this is kind of the big one. China has proven that they can build islands in the South China Sea, and the US will do nothing to stop them.
And they're calculating that the United States is not going to want to go to war over a reef in the South China Sea.
Malcolm Turnbull's back.
Hi, Matt.
He was Prime Minister while a lot of China's island-building activities in the South China Sea were going on. He says he told Xi Jinping that what he was doing there was a bad idea.
All they have done is alienate countries in the region. I mean, China is getting stronger, but it is not getting better liked.
So China has proven, essentially, that the US is not willing to go to war to stop them claiming that sea. So isn't the question then, is there a territory the US will go to war to defend? Taiwan is a geopolitical anomaly, or a geopolitical absurdity, depending on who you ask. 23 million people live on the island. It's about half the size of Tasmania, and it's very different from mainland China.
There's freedom of speech, freedom of press. So pretty much you have people speaking for all sides of any issue.
This is Catherine Wei. She's a journalist from the Straits Times based in Taiwan.
You can have protests as long as you apply for a permit with the government first. There is no crackdowns on comments that criticize the government.
And you have multiple political parties and elections.
Oh, yes, we do. The elections are a merry affair. Everybody is very invested in it. And I think democracy is so young in Taiwan, but it's advanced a lot. And even a year before every election, everyone is just gearing up to see who's going to be whom and what's going to happen.
So Taiwan is a full democracy. one of the most successful in Asia. But it doesn't call itself the Republic of Taiwan. It calls itself the Republic of China. That's because, well, their constitution says that they are the actual government of China, that the Chinese Communist Party and its president, Xi Jinping, are imposters pretending to be in charge of a country that doesn't belong to them. It's been that way for 70 years, and it's all because of a decades-long battle between two men, General Chiang Kai-shek and Chairman Mao Zedong. At the beginning of World War II, China was a military dictatorship led by General Chiang Kai-shek.
And by the outbreak of World War II, had ruled the nation for 10 years, troubled continuously by a militant Communist Party led by Mao Zedong.
Mao and Chiang were bitter rivals, but World War II brought them a common enemy, the Japanese, who invaded and took control of about a third of the country. Japan also controlled Taiwan. It had claimed it as a colony in the 19th century. Mao and Chiang put their civil war on hold to fight alongside the US, Britain and Australia in World War II.
They had disagreed on different things, but ultimately they fought off the Japanese.
Winning the war came with a number of perks for Chiang. He was given control of Taiwan and, as one of the five primary winners of the war, gained a permanent seat on the newly formed UN Security Council, giving him enormous international influence. There was a downside to winning the war, though. For his alliance with Mao.
By 1945, with the Japanese beaten, that uneasy alliance fell apart.
Mao versus Chiang was back on. The Chinese Civil War restarted. Chiang's Nationalist Party realised they were in trouble.
The Communist Party had expanded so much, they had outnumbered the Nationalist Party.
As Mao's communist forces approached Beijing, Chiang and the Nationalists decided to relocate.
The Nationalist Party decided, oh, this is not going great. We're outnumbered. We have to take all our resources and flee.
And Chiang Kai-shek, together with 2 million of his followers, fled to the offshore island of Taiwan.
They retreated to Taiwan and they wanted to remobilize their forces to take back China.
Why did Mao not immediately invade and take the island?
I think he was also trying to get China under control and it was not steady footing for him in the beginning. He didn't have enough aircrafts or enough naval vessels to immediately invade Taiwan.
Chiang took all the US-made military jets and ships left over from World War II with him. So while Mao had the larger army and could quickly bring Tibet, Xinjiang and Hainan under his control, he couldn't cross the 100-mile-wide strait to take Taiwan. A bizarre stalemate emerged. Chiang's air force and navy controlled the air and sea. Mao's army controlled the land. The US Navy moved into the 100-mile-wide Taiwan Strait to make sure it was uncrossable by either side. It was 1949, and the Civil War was frozen.
To this day, Chiang Kai-shek and his beaten army have refused to admit defeat.
This all came as quite a surprise to the people who actually lived on the island.
When Chiang Kai-shek and his 2 million followers retreated to Taiwan, they found 13 million local inhabitants, ethnically similar to the mainland Chinese, but culturally far different.
Catherine Wei's grandparents were Taiwanese, and they were used to the Japanese way of doing things.
My grandma and grandpa both completed their elementary school education under the Japanese rule.
Japanese rule had come with a lot of benefits. A good school system, modern cities.
They were very strict, they were oppressive, but there was rule and order, and according to my grandparents, they and their families appreciated that.
But when Chiang's army arrived, everything changed. Chiang Kai-shek ruled Taiwan as a harsh military dictator.
You had to be very careful of who you talked to and what you said, because a lot of phones were tapped by the government. They were looking for people who may be looking to overthrow them and for people who wanted to start rival political parties. So I would say my grandparents lived in fear because they wanted to preserve their identities, but they also wanted to keep their family alive.
That all sounds pretty awful, but as Mao was a communist and this was the Cold War, the United States decided to back Chiang. This is US President Dwight Eisenhower in 1958 showing his support.
Powerful dictatorships are attacking an exposed but free area. The United States cannot accept the result that the communists seek.
A deal was struck between Chiang and the US.
Chiang Kai-shek is pledged not to invade the mainland without American approval. This follows a pact by the United States to defend Taiwan from communist attack.
And that pact came with a significant cash bonus to help Chiang Kai-shek get his country running. And here's the thing.
Now things are booming, thanks to Chinese industry and America's golden handshake.
The economy went off like a rocket.
People here are doing well, and Taiwan claims the second healthiest economy in Asia after Japan. So much has been achieved.
For 20 years, the Western world recognised Chiang Kai-shek's government, ruling over the tiny island of Taiwan, as the actual government of China. Not Mao's government, the one in Beijing controlling the entire rest of China.
Taiwan, for example, had China's seat in the United Nations. In other words, the Republic of China in Taiwan was recognised by the global community as being China, and the communist regime was therefore regarded by many countries, including Australia, as being in that sense illegitimate.
But the 70s brought with it a new American president and a new view of China.
The meeting between the leaders of China and the United States is to seek the normalization of relations between the two countries.
Richard Nixon, realizing that the situation was rather ridiculous and also getting in the way of potentially making a lot of money trading with China, decided to recognize Mao and the communist government as being the true leaders of China. Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government was kicked out of the United Nations.
The nationalist flag was lowered last night before the final vote, and UN officials confessed today that they don't yet have the red banner of the People's Republic. In the General Assembly, the nameplates have always simply read China. So there'll be no need for alteration.
And Chiang's hugely influential seat on the UN Security Council was given to Mao. And yet Nixon kind of wanted things both ways. He made it clear they were not abandoning Taiwan.
Our action in seeking a new relationship with the People's Republic of China will not be at the expense of our old friends.
Nixon's top foreign policy guy, Henry Kissinger, agreed to a new approach to China, which recognised there is but one China and acknowledged Beijing's claim that Taiwan is a province of China. This became known as the One China policy.
Now, we go through this, in effect, fiction of, recognising the One China policy.
Here's how it works. According to the original constitution adopted in Taiwan, the president there controls all of China, including the mainland, and the South China Sea too. They also like the nine dash line. According to the constitution sitting in Beijing, the current president, Xi Jinping, controls all of China, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. The One China policy, which the US adopted, is that Beijing is right, except for the bit about the South China Sea, and also leave Taiwan alone if you know what's good for you. It is, as Malcolm Turnbull says, a fiction. It's nonsensical. It's ambiguous about what would even happen if China did try to invade Taiwan. And that's deliberate. Kissinger called it strategic ambiguity, meaning that nobody's quite sure what it means, but they don't test it because they're scared of finding out. The consequences of this were bizarre. In Taipei, the Taiwanese capital, MPs sat in the parliament representing the mainland they could not visit.
The present residents of Shanghai may not appreciate it, but their ageing delegate still represents their interests in Taiwan's Assembly Hall.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the Communist government of China claimed to be speaking on behalf of people in Taiwan, which they have never controlled. The One China policy is still in place to this day. Chiang died, Mao died, but the countries never came back together.
Taiwan has developed into, for all intents and purposes, an independent country. The question is not whether some exiled political party in Taiwan really should be running China. That's not the question any longer. The question is whether Taiwan should be able to continue to exercise its freedoms in its democracy.
And yet Taiwan still does not claim to be independent. They claim to be still part of China. They just have a different opinion about who is in charge of it. The government in Beijing has made it clear that if Taiwan declares independence, they will be extremely displeased.
We seriously warn those Taiwan independence forces that those who play with fire will set themselves on fire. Taiwan independence means war.
And Xi Jinping has made it clear that he wants to see Taiwan properly become part of China. His China.
Returning Taiwan to the motherland is a huge strategic objective of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party. And the question is, how much of a price and how much risk are they prepared to take to achieve that?
Recently, the South China Sea has become a bit of a testing ground for that. China has started to see how far they can go. In the northeastern part of the pizza is an island controlled by Taiwan called Prattis Island. Taiwan says if you fly a plane anywhere near it, or any other bit of Taiwanese territory, you have to identify yourself or they will shoot you down. But in mid-April this year,
Taiwan reported multiple Chinese jets and bombers had flown into its air defence zone.
On the 12th of April, the Chinese Air Force flew 18 fighter jets, 4 bombers, 2 anti-submarine planes and a radar plane over and around the island. The Taiwanese Air Force scrambled jets into the area to basically tell the Chinese planes to rack off, which they eventually did. This was the largest in a series of similar incidents over the last few months and led to some pretty scary speculation.
There are two schools of thought about whether this is just an intimidation tactic or whether it's the precursor to an invasion and a full-on armed takeover of the island of Taiwan.
The United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken responded by telling Xi that he should not use force to try and take control of the island.
It would be a serious mistake for anyone to try to change the existing status quo by force.
This is scary. See, the US has promised to help Taiwan to defend itself.
The reality is that a conflict over Taiwan could easily turn into a nuclear war. You know, there's no point kidding yourself about that. The stakes are very high. The ladder of escalation could result in a truly horrific Armageddon-type conflict. There's no question about that.
Many military experts say the US will simply not get involved. Taiwan is not worth nuclear war. Nobody actually wants a war to happen, including Xi Jinping. But he's convinced he can get his way without war. And it's not with a new plan, it's with an old one, called One Country, Two Systems. Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping came up with it in 1979. He said if Taiwan would just admit they were part of his country, he would allow them to keep their economic and social systems, government, and military. It didn't fly in Taipei.
Up to now, the Taiwanese response to offers of internal autonomy and a share in the overall leadership has been negative.
So he tried a test run with Hong Kong. You see, Hong Kong was governed by Britain as a colony for over 100 years, until finally Britain and China arranged a deal.
The British government remains fully committed to the full implementation of the concept of one country, two systems.
The plan, which would take effect in 1997, would mean Hong Kong was part of China, but could keep acting like it was independent for 50 years before becoming entirely Chinese in 2047. And this idea had many supporters.
This is Helen Shamho. Can you hear me, mate?
Sounds great. Dr. Helen Shamho is Australian. She sat in the New South Wales Parliament for 14 years as a Liberal, then an Independent. Since 2000, she's been involved in the Australian Council for the Promotion of Peaceful Reunification of China. And in 1997, when the Chinese leader promised nothing would change, that Hong Kong would stay autonomous, she believed him.
Deng Xiaoping, who was the president then at the time, actually said there would be 50 years unchanged in Hong Kong. He pledged that. And so because he was a very powerful figure, although he's a small man, so we trust them.
She even thought Taiwan would soon follow. A lot of people did.
And it has been imprinted in my mind that Taiwan, Hong Kong, and some independent territory, they would get into one China.
Helen Shamho says it's only recently that people in Taiwan have started to call themselves Taiwanese.
The young generations have no feeling of China because their parents, their grandparents are Chinese, but they feel that they are just Taiwanese because they were born in Taiwan.
And a lot of people agreed that reunification was inevitable.
There was a period when people who are more optimistic about China's political development would have said, oh, well, Taiwan's democratized, China itself will democratize and liberalize, and at some sort of misty point in the future, you know, they won't have any problems getting back together because they'll share similar democratic values.
But in the past few years, a series of events in Hong Kong may have ruined any chance of a happy Taiwan reunification.
Well, of course, you know, you couldn't persuade anyone in Taiwan of that any longer, if you ever could.
In August of 2019, more than a million Hong Kongers took to the streets to protest a new extradition law. But Xi Jinping put an end to the protests in mid-2020 with a national security law cracking down on free speech and protest.
Hong Kong is dead! Hong Kong is dead!
It was sweeping and draconian.
Su Lin Wong, a journalist for The Economist, was in Hong Kong at the time and said the change was immediate.
That really sent chills throughout the city. Like, overnight, I could feel the change in the city.
Suddenly, mainland China was no longer leaving Hong Kong to their own system. They were imposing a significant amount of influence over the city. Dozens of well-known activists have been arrested for taking part in protests which happened before the legislation was passed.
People were scrubbing their social media accounts. People were being arrested for holding up blank pieces of paper on the streets of Hong Kong in protest. Popular chants and songs from the 2019 protests suddenly became illegal.
Helen Sham-ho says Beijing was entirely within their rights to do what they did.
Because it's their own territories, they can do what they like, in a sense. But because Deng Xiaoping has said there's no change, but there's not big changes though. This is just a matter of management.
And that China is now a country Hong Kongers should be happy to be part of.
In the last, I would say, 20, 30 years, China changed so much, it's not funny. I'm amazed. I'm very impressed with their progress. What I'm saying, they are happy.
But a lot of people in Hong Kong don't see it that way.
I mean, I think really what we've seen is the death of liberalism in China's freest city.
Catherine Wei says Beijing's handling of Hong Kong put a complete end to any prospect of one country, two systems in Taiwan.
They're saying today's Hong Kong will be tomorrow's Taiwan. People are, I think even people who didn't want to choose a side prior to this have now made up their minds that no, this is not what we want.
But Xi Jinping is not only trying to convince people in Taiwan that reunification is the way to go. He's trying to convince the broader international community of that as well. China's spectacular economic growth in the last 40 years makes a pretty strong case to many that the Communist Party are leading their country in the right direction.
President Xi is all powerful. Whatever he says, it's done. And that's very efficient. That's how they achieve their growth and their impressive development, actually. I think that the growth of China is spectacular, almost to the extent of being miraculous.
He's hoping that the rest of the world will finally back him over Taiwan and allow him to impose one country, two systems, whether they like it or not. All of this is making the world a lot more complicated for Australia and the United States. Much like climate policy, China policy is an incredibly complex long-term issue that requires well-considered decision-making and leadership. And yet political leaders have made it clear, repeatedly, that they don't have a strong understanding of the issue. In 2016, incoming US President Donald Trump violated the One China policy by taking a congratulatory phone call from the president of Taiwan.
This was a call put into me. I didn't make the call. And it was a call, very short call, saying, congratulations, sir, on the victory. It was a very nice call.
Now, presumably, Trump didn't decide at that moment, you know, while the phone was ringing, that he was going to reverse decades of China policy by recognizing the government of Taiwan. He just didn't know what he was doing. Nevertheless, instead of admitting he made a mistake, he decided to double down.
I fully understand the One China policy, but I don't know why we have to be bound by a One China policy.
This year, in the midst of escalating tension with Beijing, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison was being interviewed by 3AW radio host Neil Mitchell when he was asked about Taiwan.
Do we stand with Taiwan?
Look, we've always honoured all of our arrangements in the Indo-Pacific.
He started a pretty standard answer about honouring our existing commitments and then said this.
We have always understood the one system, two countries arrangement, and we will continue to follow our policies there.
So does that mean we stand with Taiwan?
One country, two systems, I should say, yeah.
You shouldn't say. It's not one system, two countries, or one country, two systems. That's what Beijing wants and what Taiwan has spent 40 years resisting. Australia's policy is the one China policy. It's a simple mistake. As I said earlier, it's a complex and at times nonsensical arrangement, but that's what it is. But like Donald Trump, instead of admitting he made a mistake when asked about it by SBS, he doubled down.
Did he make a mistake in that comment?
No.
Then the government said he was actually talking about Hong Kong. And maybe he was, but he was asked about Taiwan. Most Australians probably see this as a pretty unimportant issue, but it's... well, it's not. Every decision we make about our economy is underpinned by our trading relationship with China. Every decision we make about our national security is underpinned by our diplomatic relationship with China. And yet occasionally, politicians from across the political spectrum show that they don't fully understand it or decide to throw it all up in the air in order to score some short-term domestic political points. We're talking about our jobs and our lives here. This is the story of the 21st century, and Australia needs to understand it to figure out how we fit into it. China, If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. It's produced by Iris Zhao, Will Ockenden and Amelia Tan. Our series producer is Yasmin Parry. Our podcast lead is Eric George and our managing editor is Tanya Nolan. The ABC's associate managing editor of Asia Pacific News is Matthew O'Sullivan. If you want more analysis of the latest China news, check out the ABC's new weekly TV program, China Tonight with Stan Grant. It's available now on iView. This is the final episode of this season of China If You're Listening. Remember, you can find me on Twitter, at Matthew Bevan. If you like this season, you can leave a rating and review on Apple. We hope you've enjoyed the season, and we hope to be back with more soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.